current time is now 7:28 p.m. here in Seoul, South Korea. It's time for our Thursday's Made in Korea, and making it into the studio, Professor John DeMoya from Seoul National University. Good to see you again, Professor.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we've talked about former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung in our previous episode, obviously well known for an advocate of Korean democracy, his Nobel Prize in Peace. His time in exile in the early 1980s is something that is seldom discussed, and a lot of things is something that a lot of people forget as well. But what was going on as Chun Doo-hwan consolidated his presidency and tensions rose with Korean workers and students since the 1980s? We'll talk about all of this. But before all that, where was Kim Dae-jung before 1985, and what circumstances led to his exile between 1982 and 1985?
Sure. Quickly, he was in the United States between December 82 and February 85 when he'll return to Korea. And that's often described as his kind of exile. Mm-hmm. And to provide a context, if you remember, and we probably talked about this previously, Chun obviously at the process of consolidation following 1980 has Kim Dae-jung convicted in a 20-year sentence. At some point, this is even possibly a threat of death. Mm-hmm. So that probably there is some sort of deal cut where Kim is allowed to leave the country. In essence, you will go off and be sort of out of view, out of mind. You'll be less of a political problem. And in return for this, obviously, we get sort of your, not complicity, but your silence, certainly in the Korean domestic context. You will not participate politically. You won't be here. This will obviously be a great relief to the regime in power at the time.
And it doesn't look make us look that bad.
No, exactly. Precisely, because we're following the human thing by letting you go off and do your thing elsewhere.
And we've talked about before in our previous episode with former President Kim Dae-jung that there was times where he was almost killed, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like,
and
absolutely.
So this was sort of
The multiple version of
absolutely, and this is a win-win situation for both sides. I mean, we don't look as bad, and Kim Dae-jung, of course, being able to save his life and go off to the United States. But how long was Kim in the U.S.? And also, I mean, with what conditions? There must have been some sort of condition, right?
It's sure, like sure, sure.
You can quietly go there, live your rest of your life there, and enjoy whatever fattening American food has providing for you.
Sure. Okay. I think he's there a total of just about 26 months. Again, so I don't have the exact date, but sometime in December 82. And then he returns just a fact about this time in February of 85. I don't know what the understanding was on the Korean side, but clearly Kim understood that by being in the United States, he would have a chance to have a platform for his views. He is going to be living somewhere in the Boston area, and I don't know, again, the exact terms of his contract, but he's affiliated with Harvard with a center as a visiting professor slash lecturer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, and I've seen him listed on some of the accounts that he was teaching, and I sort of get this idea. You get a politician in exile who is nonetheless a very prominent foreign elite who can teach Harvard students about the process. So I believe he uses that probably as an initial forum into exploring the world of academia slash politics. He also engages in a number of editorials, op-eds, where he obviously expresses his views of the Korean political situation. And that's probably what I think the Chun administration had not anticipated, that he would be able to build a platform in that kind of way. He's definitely using that to kind of express much more openly than he could have in Korea where he stands with respect to what's going on.
And in some ways, by him being in the United States, he's well protected.
Precisely.
Right?
Precisely. And I don't know how much of this figured into the administration's calculus, but clearly Kim Dae-jung probably thought that he could do this.
Right. And Chun Doo-hwan's probably going, wait a minute.
Exactly. This is English language, and it's not necessarily filtering back to Koreans the way it would today on the internet. But nonetheless, given students and the number of graduate students abroad, I'm sure some of this is getting back that he's developing a power base and that he's becoming a voice again.
I'm curious, though, because I don't know whether or not former President Kim Dae-jung spoke fluent English.
I don't know that either.
Right.
But I know definitely, for example, later on, he published a famous piece in The Atlantic about Singapore's Asian values in English. Again, it may have been translated.
Yeah, exactly. So
but that piece is very famous because it shows his views very carefully distinguished from those of Lee Kuan Yew. And we used to teach that in Singapore to make Singapore students understand that not every Asian leader embraced the unique Singapore brand of quote-unquote democracy.
Yeah, I forget if it was with you that we talked about how sometimes there would be like graduate students who would relay news of what's happening. And maybe they were the ones that were relaying the message of what Kim Dae-jung was doing in Harvard and so forth. But was teaching in Harvard and writing these editorials the only thing that he was doing? Like, what exactly was life like in the United States for him?
I can't say exactly for material conditions, but I'm guessing that he probably has a certain number base of supporters. I also know that he was probably, in addition to Harvard, invited in other places. At some point in 83, he receives an honorary degree from Emory University. And again, he makes a talk again expressing his views about the state of Korea, Korean democracy. So I'm assuming that with supporters, honoraria, probably a little bit of money coming in from publishing and other things, I don't want to say that he was well off, but I assume that he was at least sufficiently taken care of, that at least for that period of time he was sustained. It sounds like he had a reasonable lifestyle. And in fact, just anticipating where we're going to talk in a minute or two, I'm a little bit surprised that he chose not to pursue this more long-term. That is, I think he could have easily had a very comfortable long-term settlement in the United States had he chosen to pursue that path.
And so basically lived the comfortable life of being in the United States.
Well, and again, I don't know what how long was his Harvard contract was set up, but I assume that he was reasonably well paid as a visiting lecturer, recognizing his prominence as an external expert.
Yeah, I mean, that itself, I mean, pays for, I mean, you know, living in the United States and so forth, and especially when you have a university like Harvard University.
Sure.
But at the same time, I'm also curious, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, and how the U.S. government sort of viewed him being, because again, he's exiled, and I do know that the U.S. government did sort of in some way support Chun Doo-hwan, right? I mean, they knew what was going to happen with the whole May 18th, you know.
This is, again, a really complicated calculus.
Yeah.
The way it's often portrayed, and I have to admit, I tend to focus my own work a little bit earlier in Korean history, but nonetheless, the way it's often portrayed is the switch between the Carter and the Reagan administrations. Carter, much bigger on human rights. Mm-hmm. Reagan, obviously, the usual, you know, sort of stereotype, more back to a hard line, embracing certain level of autocracy in the interest of the Cold War. My guess is that there was probably ambivalence and confusion and even uncertainty among Reagan administration people in terms of what to do with Kim Dae-jung, because certainly they are obviously strong allies with South Korea. Again, famously, Chun is, I believe, the first foreign visitor in March of 81 to visit the Reagan White House.
Right, and that
was often seen as a gesture of support for, we sort of know what's going on. Not that we're going to legitimize you, but we are going to sort of re-embrace Korea in a particular way.
Which is why amongst the Koreans, Reagan was not really that
and still.
Moving forward, right?
Moving forward.
Like, Reagan is not one of the more popular presidents out there.
But to your question, if Kim Dae-jung in 83, 84 is speaking out frequently, whether softly or more harshly, against the Chun administration from the perspective of America, I imagine this raises some... I suspect it raises some doubts and some confusion among people who work on the Korea desk in the State Department about how do we handle this. I think my best answer would be because again, this is where the United States will start to question Chun a little bit later. I think this is the beginning of the opening of the first kind of questionings of how much of that embrace do we have to really stand behind.
But, you know, Kim Dae-jung didn't stay in the United States as long as what people had anticipated he was. He was going to. But why did he end up returning to Korea? I mean, like, what aims did he return, and what was he expecting from this return?
Sure. There is some indication that he and Kim Il-sung were already talking about the famous alliance that they will make, which will later, of course, also split apart. But nonetheless, they'd been talking about ways of creating some sort of union to oppose the regime, and even obviously they couldn't know the 87 elections were coming, but just ways of finding common points where they could work together.
Sure.
So that's part of it. I think also he didn't know, and if I can just begin to mention the actual circumstances of the landing in February 87, he returns with 37 people, among whom are one or two Congress people from the U.S. Famously, also I didn't know who she was, but I had to look her up. But she's interesting. A woman named Patricia Durian, who is a former in the 60s civil rights person, in the 70s in the Carter administration, very much a human rights advocate, had some sort of fancy, I can't remember the name of the position, but it's like the undersecretary for human rights or something.
Long title.
So basically he brought all these people as kind of a posse because they really weren't sure how they were going to be received at Kimpo.
Wow.
And the analogy here is when Aquino returned to the Philippines very famously in 83, killed by Marcos, we now know by Marcos. So there were real fears that he would be not just imprisoned as he was, but bodily harmed and possibly killed. So he kind of returned with people around him that could provide a voice to what was going on. Yeah. So, no, he clearly anticipated that his return would be provocative. It's kind of a brave move.
Even the return is something that is not often talked about.
No, exactly. This was very interesting to me, exactly.
And it's very strategic, like you said. Sure, it was kind of a win-win situation for him to be able to leave to the United States. But then again, the Chanduan regime finding out, well, maybe this was not the best thing to do,
sure,
because now he's protected,
sure,
over in the United States. And he's saying all sorts of things that don't make us look bad. And he's coming back with a group of people that could potentially protect him.
At the very
again.
Least, they're as witnesses to what goes on actively. They're witnesses to history.
Exactly. So upon his return, were there any sort of consequences that he was able to face? One of our listeners, Nian, she's from Singapore. And,
sure.
Did you teach in Singapore?
Yes, I taught in Singapore for just about eight plus years.
Yeah, and she said, how'd you like Singapore? I'm happy to hear this conversation coming from Singapore. And he's right about democracy. And speaking of which, are there any comparisons with other politicians in East Asia or Southeast Asia from this time?
I'm going to make this a very loose analogy, but obviously we've already mentioned Aquino in the Philippines and later, of course, Cory Aquino after her husband is killed. The other analogy I would make, and it comes up all the time, is I don't know enough about the timeline of Taiwan and the Kuomintang opening up to opposition parties, but it is a little bit later in the 80s also. So I imagine Taiwan is also starting to think about these questions of, we've had long-term one-party rule, how do we begin to peacefully transition? And again, the Korean situation normally is portrayed as more violent than that the Kuomintang opened up. But
right,
if you talk to any Taiwanese who are DPP advocates, they'll tell you that they opened up because the DPP obviously made sacrifices and pushed back. So I would see Taiwan as an analogy. Even Singapore is weirder because obviously it hasn't transitioned yet. There's still one-party rule, but nonetheless, they also have had all kinds of conversations about what is the level of public discourse that's acceptable, where are the markers. I imagine lots of parts of the region because, again, we didn't know that 89 is coming, but people were feeling with Gorbachev in the mid-80s that the conversation was shifting.
Yeah. Let's talk about his later careers,
sure,
right? And then these are some of the things that I guess we know more of,
sure,
rather than some of the other things that we happened. He followed Kim Il-sung,
yes,
right? After Kim Il-sung. Now, Kim Il-sung's presidency obviously marred with the,
yes,
the IMF.
Yes, and it's funny because that was my first time in Korea. I guess I still feel weird, totally unjustifiable nostalgia for Kim Il-sung because he was my president when I...
Right, but I'm curious, and this is kind of off topic here. You came during the IMF.
I came just before that.
Just before
that. Yeah, unfortunately I missed IMF, but I had been in Korea parts of 95 and 96.
Ah, that's right.
I had a rich context for when it came. I was like, well, how did that happen?
So following Kim Il-sung, looking for a new leader, here comes Kim Dae-jung. How did that, the return from the United States that time, that transfers to him being the president of South Korea? There must have a lot of things that happened in between for this to happen.
The landing in February 85 itself is somewhat controversial in the sense that he's almost immediately taken to house arrest along with his wife from Kimpo. Mm-hmm. The reason it's controversial is obviously there are differing accounts on what happened at the airport. And he either peaceably came from the airport or was detained by KCIA. And he and some of the 37 people were physically persuaded to come to the house arrest. But I think this gives him a good deal of legitimacy that adds to his already previous political career in the sense that he has voluntarily chosen to come back, is willing to undergo this, so that when you have the 87 elections and the famous split between he and Kim Il-sung that splits the vote and allows right. No Taiwo to be elected, he still retains a great deal of political capital that I don't know the exact gaps between 87 and the later 90s, particularly what happens in the 92 election, and I believe he briefly retires from politics, but that he certainly remains a charismatic figure that for many Koreans will carry over into when he ultimately decides to run again.
I'm curious as whether or not he really did feel maybe there must have been something in place, or there must have been some hints as to show that there was a significant amount of support for him.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I can't believe, for example, that when he's publishing, that when he's giving talks, that he's not whatever variety of 1980s research there was, knowing about, you know, what's your support, who's, what's the size of the audience. I'm sure there was some of that. And also with the airport situation and the 37 people, I can't believe, I mean, I don't know, I assume that he notified the government, look, I'm coming back. I'm willing to accept certain conditions because I assume, like a rational human being, he did right. not want to be killed. He was just taking insurance with bringing a retinue with him.
When you see, again, and then now we're going to go into like the last stage is his presidency.
Absolutely.
And if you look at it, I guess maybe as a scholar or even just on the outside as an American, I mean, how do you sort of, you know, rate his presidency? I mean, there was a lot of things that did happen, right? I mean, you had the 2000 Inter-Korean Summit, which led to the Nobel Peace Prize right. and so forth. I mean, where does he sort of stand amongst the presidents of South Korea?
I personally find him very interesting and would regard him fairly highly in terms of his sincerity. Obviously, the negatives that come from the immediate legacy are the later, as with many South Korean presidents, possible things with family and other things.
But his son went to prison.
Yes,
so.
But in particular also with the Sunshine Policy, obviously that remains enormously controversial among Koreans in terms of the amount of money he gave to the North to get them to come to the table. But positive, I mean, he did lead the country through IMF and very quickly got those payments taken care of. And that was a really risky time when, let's see, roughly... Yeah, a decade into the move away from military rule, things really could have gone off the rails had things gone differently. And so, I mean, in terms of keeping the nation together, keeping people basically on par and managing things economically, that I would have to value very highly.
Yeah, because one of the things that I was in the United States back then, and sure. I was young.
Now I'm feeling old, but go ahead.
Going to middle school. heading into high school and so forth. I just felt like, because I remember the Kim Il-sung, hearing about the Kim Il-sung era.
Sure.
Which again, I mean, every time you mention Kim Il-sung, everyone's going to talk about IMF. And so sure. I know how bad it was in Korea, just judging by what my relatives were telling me. And then you transition over to the Kim Il-sung administration and Korea really took another leap, right? We talk about the leaps that Korea took.
Sure.
And you can say maybe it was the 2002 World Cup. I don't know what I don't think that has to do with anything. But Korea certainly took another leap. And you talked about how coming out of the IMF.
Yeah.
And so
I can't tell you the exact number of months, but if Kim Dae-jung is elected in late 97, obviously already in the crisis, and then they have to set up the payment scheme with the World Bank. I believe it's within his administration. So within two and a half years. I mean, it's incredibly quick. We talked previously about the campaign for donating gold and doing other things to the country. I'm not a political scientist, but historically, just there is a certain revival of nationalism, hopefully in a more positive way, that allows the country to fairly quickly recover from this.
Yeah, I just realized, because again, we've talked about with Professor Song before, you know, sure. the rift amongst the, you know, party support and things like that. And while again, like you said, there is a lot of controversy over the Sunshine Policy
Absolutely.
And the amount of money that was spent on that, and so obviously the conservatives not a big.
I was
going to
say this is one of the big divides in Korean politics today.
But even the conservatives will agree that what he did to kind of squeeze out of the IMF process, and it's such an unprecedented time. It was very quick,
sure,
right? Like
sure.
in and out very quick. And so that's one of the things I think he's being praised for.
If I could just offer one more contrast to something you said earlier. You said you're right that Kim Il-sung was associated with the IMF at the end of his period. But I was here in 95, 96, and I said the one palpable memory I have, and I'd have to look it up, but it has to be spring of 96 when Korea hit the 10,000 per capita income.
Mm.
And I just remember people going out into the street and kind of celebrating, going like, we are now a rich country, which people do not do. I always tell to my students, people had a lot less then, but seemed a lot happier with that because they were hitting markers that Korea had not previously hit.
Right. And we've hit, I think it's like 30,000 now, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of people complaining
without naming names, I just applied to a conference and I had to check because I was curious, but I suspected it. I had to pay a higher fee because I'm based at a university in a high income country.
Oh, goodness.
So we're now, you know, along with Europe and North America, I pay the higher fee. But I get it because they're trying to obviously spread fees out among different countries.
Professor Demoya, thank you as always. Fantastic history lesson. Have a safe rest of the weekend. We'll see you again next Thursday.
Thanks very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.